less confident.
Guilty as charged.
Fortunately, there's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. It's simple, so he can understand the details and know he's getting the right mortgage. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. Go to rocketmortgage.com today.
Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, I'm Wayne Alaroot for pre-1933.com. I've been the single biggest BBB, backer, believer, and buyer of gold for over 15 years. But now I found a better way to buy gold. I found the Uber of gold. This company, pre-1933.com, will forever change the way gold is sold. Pre-1933.com is a wholesaler of pre-1933 gold. They have no salesmen, zero commission, prices no one can compete with. Call 855-PRE-1933. That's toll-free, 855-773-1933, or go to pre-1933.com.
President Trump is headed to Miami, where he will announce some changes to Obama-era policies on Cuba. Trump tweeted that his administration will empower the Cuban people and hold the Castro regime accountable. Changes include tightening rules on Americans' travel to Cuba. The plan will also restrict U.S. companies from doing business with Cuban enterprises that are controlled by the military. Now, former President Obama started normalizing relations with the communist island nation in 2014. It would be nice if it were true, but the Pentagon cannot verify a claim made by Russia. USA's Chris Barnes explains.
Russia says it launched an airstrike on a high-level ISIS meeting in Syria last month, attended by over 300 leaders and fighters of ISIS, and it believes leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi may be among those killed. U.S. military officials say, however, they've seen no evidence to back up that claim. I'm Chris Barnes.
This is USA Radio News.
I'm KFC's extra crispy colonel, and you're the extra busy regular person who has to make dinner for a family of four. But you can shirk that responsibility because my extra crispy $20 fill-up from KFC contains 8 pieces of freshly double-breaded extra crispy chicken, 4 biscuits, 2 orders of mashed potatoes, and a side of coleslaw for just $20. That'll feed them. KFC, it's extra crispy good.
Pricing and participation may vary. Tax and substitutions extra.
So-called dreamers will be allowed to remain in the United States, at least for now. The Department of Homeland Security is letting a policy stand that keeps people who were brought to the U.S. as children from being deported. President Trump had earlier promised to allow dreamers to keep their permits to legally work in the U.S. Crews are continuing to comb through what's left of a London apartment tower that was ravaged by fire this week. The death toll so far stands at 30, but British news outlets report that number could eventually approach 100. Dozens of people are still missing. Prime Minister Theresa May has launched a full public inquiry into the tragedy. The cause of the fire is unknown, but arson is not suspected. Russian diplomats are working to obtain the release of crew members after a Russian yacht was detained by North Korea. Bill Zimfer has details.
The yacht, which was on its way through the Sea of Japan to Vladivostok, was detained by North Korean authorities for, as they put it, violating the country's border. Russia's embassy in North Korea expressed.
Come join us for the 4th annual Hunterdon County Community Day on Saturday, June 3rd from 11 to...
Don't fear technology. Use it, understand it, and embrace it. The mission of Tech Today is to demystify technology. I'm your host, Chris Bianco, principal of Blue Panther Business Partners. Every Tuesday morning from 10 to 11, we will cover new apps, buying advice, technology news, and answer your questions. Good day, and join me on Tech Today on HuntertonChamberRadio.com.
Well, welcome. This is the Sports Guys, and it's 5:04, so we're right on time. Of course, I had to cut someone off in order to do that, but that's what we're going to be doing. And the weather today, if you haven't been outside or haven't looked to the weather outside, it's not a bright, sunny, warm day. It's they said it was high about 73 degrees. Frankly, it seemed cooler, but that's because there have been showers off and on. It just hasn't been a pleasant day. And tomorrow, well, Bill, you will not be enjoying, according to this temperature and this prediction, you will not be enjoying a good time down at your boat this weekend because there's a 40% chance of showers this afternoon. And, of course, I don't know where you were, Bill, but there certainly was rain wherever I was. And tomorrow, or tonight, I should say, there's a 40% chance of thunderstorms. And then, again, there's showers and areas of fog, probably tapering off later this evening. Tomorrow, there's a 40% chance of thunderstorms and, of course, areas of fog. High of about 84 degrees tomorrow. So I guess that's not the day you're going to go down to your boat, right?
Au contraire, Pat. Although these clouds have been following me around, like that character on Little Abner, Joe Biff Spickle, we're hoping to get down there and take her out for a shakedown in between the window of opportunity we think we're going to have.
Well, hopefully.
And about 2 in the afternoon down at Ocean Gate.
Well,
we know that there's a 30% chance of rain there, and it's going to be cloudy, but they're not expecting thunderstorms until very late in the afternoon. And by that time, we think we're going to be in the car and on our way.
Well, good. Then Sunday actually looks worse because there's, again, a chance of thunderstorms. High of about 87 degrees. And, of course, the problem is when you live your life around these predictions and then you turn out to have a nice sunny day, everybody's saying, hey, wait a minute, why did you tell it was going to rain? And you would think that predictions would also always be accurate, but, you know, obviously they're not. But this week into Monday, that looks like heavy rain, about an 80% chance of heavy rain. And then Monday night, another 80% chance of heavy rain. So this is not going to be, the beginning of the week is not going to look like a great week. And we'll be back after a message about, and just plug your ears if you don't want to hear about losing weight, because this is what you're going to hear. And we'll be back with the sports guys as soon as we're done.
Lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. Let me repeat, lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. This is not a crazy diet or exercise program. No drugs, hormones, or shots. You can lose 20 to 45 pounds in 40 days with Nutrimost Resonant Frequency Technology to measure 2,800 of your body's key biomarkers. Using NRF, they can find and correct the cause of your weight problem by measuring factors affecting weight gain, including metabolism, fat burning, fat storage, appetite, detoxification, and hormonal regulation. It's safe, fast, easy, and effective, and you won't walk around hungry or have cravings. It's even doctor supervised. Schedule a body composition analysis and consultation. You can be transformed in 40 days guaranteed. This is a limited time offer, so they can't wait to see you look great.
So call 888-718-7077. That's 888-718-7077. Or visit njthin.com. That's njthin.com.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
I'm your eyes remain, stop me when I'm passing by.
It's time to visit Pamby's, the newest ice cream shop in town. Pamby's Purely Delicious Ice Cream, Gelato, and Sorbet, made in Hunterdon County from unique blends of natural extracts, herbs, and spices. Created with a rich, creamy texture bursting with flavor. Tickle your palate with exotic flavors such as rose cardamom, hot mango, and ginger lemon. Or satisfy your craving for dark chocolate, pecans, and caramel. Located on Route 31 south of Clinton. Pamby's Purely Delicious.
See now all my flavors are guaranteed to satisfy.
Okay, we're back with the sponsor. Back with the sponsors. Back with the sports guys. But I will have to say, if you haven't been to our sponsor, Pamby, for ice cream, it is delicious. Bill, they're at a small, what used to be a little bitty diner, north on 31, north of Payne, a little bit south of Molasses Hill, and they're on the southbound side, and the ice cream is excellent. And in fact, the other day, I have to say, I didn't realize that their spring hours started at 3 o'clock. I don't know when they go into summer hours, but Dave and I showed up at about 2:45, not realizing that they weren't open then. And this very nice woman who was working inside actually opened a store for us. So If you have a chance, we want you to, you know, try to, you know, just go to all of our sponsors. I mean, these are all local business people, but, you know, some people you might not be able to, you know, might not need a storage unit, but everybody, I think everybody needs ice cream. But then I'm one of those.
How would you not need ice cream?
I know. I'm one of those people that would eat ice cream and do eat ice cream all winter. But anyway, Bill, you know, what do you have to say about the Stanley Cup and 2 years in a row for the Penguins?
Well, the Penguins have done it again, a team that I love to hate because, as you know, I'm a Philadelphia Flyers fan, has done it again. They managed to oust Nashville in six games. My hat's off to Pittsburgh. They got good goaltending from Matt Murray and Theo Fleury, Marc-Andre Fleury, rather. Additionally, they got some very good play from Chris Kunitz, who I think is the unsung hero of the Stanley Cup's final series because made some great passes, scored some excellent goals, managed to draw a lot of defense away from Sidney Crosby, and gave Crosby a chance to play well. The other thing you have to give Pittsburgh credit for is their defense was very aggressive on the puck. They stayed hard, and they forced the Nashville game to the outside. And Nashville, as many hockey fans will know, likes to bring the puck into the slot. Pittsburgh also had an interesting statistic. They managed to block more shots in this Stanley Cup final than they had blocked in any other Stanley Cup final, semifinal, or conference final that they had been in the past, which is interesting. And by the way, don't take anything away from Nashville. Although I think they were outplayed by Pittsburgh in many of the games, they hung in there, and it looks like their trade for P.K. Subban paid off well because he managed to keep Sidney Crosby off an awful lot of the score sheets. And
you really like him, right? You're really hot on, is it PJ or PK?
PK Subban is a great player. PK Subban is a native of Montreal. He was traded for Shea Weber, who was another great defenseman who went to Montreal from Nashville. And, you know, PK has got an exuberant personality. He's got a great style. He told Sidney Crosby he had bad breath a couple of times during the series, and Sidney was asked about that by the press and declined comment because he's Sidney Crosby. But it was a fun game and a fun series of games. I only got to watch four out of the six, but I can tell you that the goaltending was even. In my opinion, I thought that Pickering, a very good goaltender who hails from Finland and who plays for Nashville, is really a guy to watch. I've seen games where I've actually attended in Philadelphia and in New Jersey where Pickering literally stood on his head when Nashville was not playing well and kept them in the game for almost three periods, and finally Nashville got a couple of goals against Philadelphia late in the game in the last 2 minutes and managed to win 2-1.
Well, let me ask you something else. I saw some women's soccer this weekend, U.S. Norway. Women won 1-0. And, of course, did you see anything with the men's soccer against Mexico? And he's nodding his head. No, no, no. He watches hockey, football, baseball, I mean these men's sports. But if you really watch some of the soccer, it's pretty, these guys are really pretty incredible. I mean, talk about athletic and being out there on the field for a long time. As I recall, at least one of the men, U.S. men, and I don't remember who it was on the field the entire time, or almost the entire time. I mean, it's very challenging. I mean, they are back and forth. Think about basketball. They go back and forth, right? But what's the size of a court as compared to the size of, you know, a soccer field?
I think a soccer field is, what, 100
yards? It's huge. And then and you have to, too bad, if nothing else, you have to take a look at the stadiums. I mean, these stadiums, I think the stadium in Mexico holds, and I don't want to guess, but I think it may even be 120,000 people.
I thought it was 110 or 120,000 yeah. people. That's the one right in Mexico City.
Right, but I mean,
that's a national stadium.
Beautiful stadium, but I mean, you know, think about it. I mean, there's not any, you know, baseball doesn't get that many people in this country. You know, football, you get 70. Is one of the bigger stadiums, what, 80,000? What's Dallas? How big is Dallas?
I don't remember. I think Dallas is about 75,000 people.
Right.
Probably. But you're right. But remember, you've got college football stadiums that seat 80 to 100.
Yeah, but other than the Rose Bowl, I think, and the Big House, I mean, I think, is the Rose Bowl or the Big House larger? Do you know?
I don't.
I don't either, but I know those are two of the larger stadiums.
Now, I have to tell you, I've always wanted to go to a Rose Bowl and see the Tournament of Roses parade and then see the football game, and that's certainly on my bucket list.
Oh, I've done it.
I'd love to see that happen.
I've done it maybe, I don't know, three times, four times. Certainly we've gone, I think, every time Wisconsin has played, mm-hmm. And honestly, as far as the bucket list, I know this is a sports show, but you know anybody should go to the Tournament of Roses, that parade sometime. It is really unbelievable. Not only do you stand there with thousands of people watching the parade, but then the best thing to do is go the next day to see all the floats. I mean, up close, you can see the floats up close. They're all parked. And the flowers, I mean, remember, everything on those floats are natural. And, I mean, they have nuts, and they have seeds, and they have flowers. I mean, it is unbelievable. And, of course, you know, the themes are always interesting. But I could probably, you know, go to that parade every year and not get bored. It's the only parade that I like more than that one, of course, is St. Patrick's Day. And I don't care if you see 100 bands. They're all great. But anyway, getting back to sports.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. You know, we have hit a milestone with the Philadelphia Phillies. They are officially here in the middle of June, 17 games out of first place. And if this continues, they might just finish first, but in one of the minor leagues, because they seem to be cellar dwellers. The Phillies, as I pointed out here on the show in the past, have lost well over 10,000 games in their storied history of futility. Now, I've always been a Phillies fan, because in Philadelphia, you want to see a baseball game. The joke is you could drive to Baltimore or New York, but if you don't feel like driving
or Trenton
on the turnpike, you go to Philly.
Or Trenton.
There you go.
You probably see a better game.
Trenton Thunder, you might
better
well
see a better game by the Trenton Thunder. In fact,
and
folks,
certainly the beer is cheaper, but the end result is you don't get to sit in this beautiful Citizens Bank Park and look at the beautiful Philadelphia skyline while watching the game.
Hey, you know what? Trenton, if you haven't been there, folks, Trenton Stadium is really a nice, small stadium, as is the Patriots Stadium. I mean, I think that, you know, it's just a, and especially for kids. I mean, you know, most kids, younger ones at least, don't understand baseball. And I will apologize for the Macy boys and other kids. And, you know, the kids that play today are really diehard. But, and if you look at Diamond Nation, you'd think that the entire nation is playing baseball. But in fact, it's not, and I don't see as much interest with the younger generation. But it's a great place to take them, the kids out to a ball game, either in Trenton or at Patriots Stadium, because there's a lot going on. And I think we sometimes neglect our local teams, and I don't want to do that, because I think that you know, there's certain things that, you know, people should go to every year. For example, I was talking to someone the other day who would never miss a football game, and it's a once a year high school game, and probably the entire town turns out.
Well, that's exciting.
And you know which one it is?
No.
Right here in New Jersey. The Phillipsburg-Easton game. Isn't that every Thanksgiving? I think it is.
A traditional game around these parts, isn't it?
And it's so traditional, and everybody goes. And, you know, Phillipsburg has not quite made up to the number of games that Easton has won. But it is, you know, these are diehard fans, and it's so great. And a number of these high school athletes do get scholarships to go on to play college. But anyway, getting back, I'm going to play a couple spots because we do have a guest who's supposed to be coming in and running a little late. So let's get a few spots out of the way so we can come back and spend all the time with our guest when he gets here.
This is Tony Clark, para-planner at Patton Heide & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heide & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heide & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Okay, we're back, and Bill, we're still the only sports guys here so far. I know our guest is going to be a little late. Do you want to talk about our guest at all,
sure,
so we don't have to spend
sure,
time
Pat,
when he gets here?
But before we do that, let me talk about what's going on with my New York Yankees. The Yankees are on the West Coast playing Oakland again tonight. They've suddenly begun to hit another speed bump with their pitching. Their great Japanese pitcher has had what I'm going to call the yips. He doesn't seem to be placing the ball very well. And we're going to be talking to our guest, Nick Molinaro, a sports psychologist, about that. CC Sabathia has just been put on the disabled list. So the Yankees are reaching down deep into their minor league team at Scranton to bring a couple of young pitchers up. And the other thing is that they had used during one of the games with the Angels earlier in this week, they had five guys pitching, and they each went two or three innings. The game went into extra innings. The Yankees finally lost an extra inning, but they lost two out of three in California, which is not something that makes them happy, or me happy, and they've lost one last night in Oakland. So we have the Yankees, is the bloom going off the rose, or is this just another temporary speed bump in a very long baseball season? Time will tell. Meanwhile, we do have a special guest coming in. He had a flat tire on 287, but we're expecting him momentarily. His name is Nick Molinaro. He's a licensed clinical psychologist who does both counseling psychology and sports psychology, and he helps a lot of athletes, particularly a lot of amateur and professional golfers, football players, and others, getting over what I call the yips. You ever had the yips in a game, Pat?
Well, I think, you know, what I see is that there are some people who are so competitive that no matter what happens, they don't get down on it. In other words, they may be losing, but there are some people like a LeBron James, for example, and I say that just because of recently, at least he always keeps trying. You don't see him, and sometimes you see tennis players where you just kind of see that they've given up. And so I'm sure that Nick will be able to talk about what he does so people don't have or don't get or get over what you call the yips?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, I can tell you that stress, if it's handled right, is a good thing. Stress, if it's handled wrong, can be very destructive. And I think it's how you have to approach these things. I can tell you that early in my career, the way I approached a court appearance that was going to be difficult was to be super prepared and to do the work in advance. But, you know, we have our expert here, Nick Molinaro. Good afternoon, Nick. Nick is a sports psychologist and clinical psychologist who has worked with many, many different athletes and with teams. Nick got a bachelor's degree from University of Scranton. His master's is from Kane University here in New Jersey. He holds a New Jersey School of Psychologist certificate issued by Seton Hall, and he's licensed by the state of New Jersey. His specialties are counseling, human development, and sports psychology. Nick also did his graduate work in counseling psychology and human development at Fairleigh Dickinson University here in New Jersey, and his postgraduate training at San Diego University, my alma mater, Temple University, and College of William and Mary.
Yeah, well, I'd rather, I bet he had more fun when he was in San Diego rather than Philadelphia.
Well,
but
I don't know. You'd have a lot of fun in Philadelphia.
I don't know. But I'd like to ask Nick, because I understand that your subspecialty, or maybe your specialty these days, is sports psychology. Very interesting. I'd like to find out, you know, forget all the academics, but how
right.
did you get interested in sports psychology?
Well, it's a long story. After I graduated undergraduate and went on to my master's and I started my doctoral degree, I became a director of special services, and I started racing cars. And I came down the downhill at Lime Rock, and I lifted, spun the car, went into the wall, got a concussion, and broke my arm. So I knew that if I was going to race again, I had to figure out a way not to be anxious down the downhill. And that's how it started.
Well, let me just interrupt you, but understand, was one of the ways, and, you know, this was my father's sports psychology. I'll never forget, I was on a horse and really got thrown, and this was a big horse. And, you know, guess what? I had to get right back on that horse. That was his sports psychology because
right.
he said, if you don't, you'll become afraid. And one of the most important things is one of the things that holds you back in any sports is fear of failure. So now I interrupted, but now let's hear more of your story.
Well, I can't disagree about getting back on a horse quickly. The problem with the car is that I had to take a little time off, obviously, because of the concussion. So during my time off, I found a way to minimize my anxiety and got back in a race car and was actually quicker the next year. That's how this whole thing started.
Well, that really is interesting because so many of us end up doing something because of something, you know, that was a fluke. And you might have
right.
done, you were still going to be doing and working in psychology.
I was a clinical psychologist.
But just the question is, why did you get interested in that? Well, tell us, you know, can you give us some, let's say you have a young amateur high school baseball player or football player who's having, you know, some anxiety or has not been performing up to what he's capable of, you know, what kinds of things would you do? How do you work with these young people?
Well, to begin with, every athlete that I see, whether it's a high school athlete or a professional or Olympic level, all have a test, mental skills test that I administer to them. And the mental skills test measures 20 functions under pressure. And after we're able to identify what those functions are or dysfunctions, then we start to train them. So a good example might be a quarterback who's having trouble throwing over the center. And when I heard what he was having trouble with, it was because he was using a method that was possible to hit the receiver versus probability. So we had a rule in place for him that if there wasn't 85% chance of him getting the ball to the receiver, don't try it.
Well, I guess this wasn't Brett Favre because he would throw to anybody and right. nobody at all and expect somebody to magically, you know, so forget even possibility. I mean, he would right. throw when there was no possibility. I'm sorry, I right. didn't mean to interrupt, but boy, that was such an example of someone who.
But you know, Pat, that's a very good point that you bring up, and that's called effective decision making when you're under pressure. For an athlete, that's a critical yes. thing. You know, I played hockey as a young guy, and the question was whether to keep the puck or to pass it or where to put it. Play anticipation is very important in an awful lot of sports. So how do you help players make good decisions under pressure in the middle of the game?
Well, again, you know, as we do this mental skills assessment, we're looking at how they're making those decisions. So, for example, this individual made very quick decisions and didn't formulate enough by being able to see the broader perspective, which is described as attentional shifting. And so we taught him how to maintain his vision but change his focus so he could look straight ahead but be able to pick other pieces of information up.
Well, that's really important because I believe that one of, and you don't know me, we haven't met, but I'm a diehard football fan and Green Bay Packer fan. And I really do believe that one of the reasons that Aaron Rodgers is such an effective quarterback is you're right. He's looking, or it looks like he's looking one way, but he has such great peripheral vision that I think he, the defense sometimes doesn't even know where he's looking. And so they're concentrated on one area right. where he has that ability. Right. And so what you're telling us is that you can actually help athletes develop something like that?
Yes, we call it attentional shifting. So imagining listening to a great piece of music. You can hear the whole symphony, or you can pick out the bass, or you can pick out the oboe or the flute. And you've literally shifted your attention to listen to something very specifically. The same thing we do with visual attention. Being able to shift the attention, in spite of the fact that peripheral vision is picking things up, how do you know what to attend to? So just like you can direct your attention and listening to music, you could do the same thing visually. And that's what we do with the quarterback, for example.
Very interesting.
It is interesting. It's a question of focus. It's like if you want to listen to the rhythm guitar player in a band
right.
or the drummer or perhaps the flute player. One of the things that was curious to me was the ability to control stress and its impact on performance. How do you cope? How do you help somebody cope who's got some performance anxiety before a tennis match or a court appearance or when they're walking up to home plate to bat?
Right. Well, we look at different forms of anxiety. Some anxiety is inborn. It's a predisposition. And individuals that are more creative are more prone to becoming anxious. So when we do the assessment, if we have a high anxiety score there, frequently I'll look at whether or not there's a history of creativity, which means that the thresholds are going to be lower. We can identify children at the age of 11 months that are going to be anxious when they get older. So try as we tell someone not to be nervous, that won't work. Don't think about pink elephants and what can you think about? So what we do ahead of the competition, we do pre-competition preparation, we identify very specific skills that the athlete has. Now, these are physical skills and mental skills. And then we set up a challenge for them. And we only set up a challenge that they can meet. So maintaining control over their mind and body, being able to breathe, and being able to move your attention away from thoughts to images. So you can't have a negative thought and a positive image at the same time. It's impossible. So as soon as the negative thought comes up, we shift almost as if you had a remote control over to an image in your mind. And that image should be related to the performance. So, for example, you know, a golfer who's going to be hitting a chip shot versus a full swing, we would work on a very specific aspect of their swing, and they turn their attention to that. And as long as they're seeing that in their mind or feeling it in their body, the thoughts actually go away. So this is all pre-programmed before they get onto the field, to the course, to the horse.
So you're telling me, since I'm not very creative, I have low stress. Not creative, but low stress, which is probably true.
Well, on the other hand, I come from a family where people are fairly creative, and we all seem to have a little bit more anxiety than others. And, you know, part of it, I think, is the overactive imagination. It imagines all of the things that go wrong at night.
Right.
When you're lying there at 2 in the morning wondering about this or that, or how much do I have in my bank account, or all those other things that modern people worry about, including whether a meteor is going to land on the roof of your house.
Well, anxiety occurs before every competition. Would you go to a Super Bowl if you knew who won? And so part of competition is what we describe as arousal levels. And if the arousal level gets too high, then it becomes anxiety. People who are not creative also are anxious. I don't want to miss that point. But before every competition, there should be a heightening of energy and heartbeats racing, that kind of thing. And sometimes that's misconstrued as anxiety, when all of that actually is an arousal level. So we need to control arousal levels, and we do that by breathing techniques and imaging techniques and rehearsing before they actually get onto the field of competition.
Let me ask you, because I, in an earlier life, had a master's in psychology, and back then there was a lot of, I was really a behaviorist. And is that some of what you're doing, is kind of behavior modification, or would you say no, totally not?
No, I would actually say very much so. I use reciprocal inhibition, desensitization, so if you've done any
right.
behavioral work, you know what that is. I also use hypnosis, so certain triggers will also produce different responses in the athlete.
Now, would you hypnotize the athletes yourself? Or?
Yes, no. Most of my athletes, high school age and up, have been hypnotized at least once.
Have not or have?
Have been.
Have. Interesting.
Yeah, most. And some of the professionals I've hypnotized more than 20 times or so. Yes.
Now, what do you find when hypnotized? And by the way, I believe that it can work for a lot of different things, but what do you find the benefit that you usually find with the athlete after you've been able to hypnotize them?
It teaches them to control their mind and to shift their attention to where it needs to be and to self-regulate. So typically, if we have someone who's had some anxiety walking into the batter's box, so just before they get into the box, they'll put their feet, you know, walk into the batter's box, and as soon as their foot's down, there may have been a trigger that now, as soon as that happens, your entire body relaxes, or your attention becomes even more keen. So we will give suggestions that are like that. And so they will relax. Performance goes up. I certainly wouldn't say this is the only system that we use, but it can be very effective, very effective.
I can tell you that hypnosis can be very effective. I've been hypnotized, and it's a very interesting phenomenon. And this was in college. I was playing baseball, and I was having trouble picking up the balls in the pitcher's hand. And I was given a suggestion that as the pitcher went into his windup, take a deep breath. And as the pitcher began to release the ball, begin to exhale, and somehow it became easier to see the ball. And my batting average went up. I was actually able to see the ball spin, and it made it easier to anticipate the ball's movement between a curve, a slider, or a fastball. So I'm with you on the hypnosis. What's very interesting to me, though, is what goes on in the brain physiologically when somebody is hypnotized help them with their sports anxiety or with their anxiety in the rest of their life, their business anxiety or work anxiety?
Well, hypnosis is actually a very natural state. And if we weren't bombarded by so many stimuli, we'd actually be in a hypnotic state. So it's very natural. All hypnosis does is teach the person how to do that to themselves, how to intensely focus on one thing and lose awareness of something else. If you've been as athletes, you will know that at times you're in a zone or in a flow state. Now, that's really resembles what goes on in a hypnotic state, is that there's an intense concentration on one very specific thing and a loosening of awareness of something else. So, for example, when you go into a movie theater, and you see the movies, and the lights come up when it's all over, and all of a sudden you see hundreds of people around you. You've lost awareness of them. And at times you'll leave theater, and you'll have such a powerful impact of that movie, and it stays with you because you're actually experiencing that at a different level of consciousness. So hypnosis is a very natural state. And so what it actually does with the brain is it modifies responses to where a thinking will be kind of over-arousing and move more into images, which is very soothing. And so if you look at PET scans, positron emission tomography, you'll see different functions of the brain under hypnosis.
That's a fascinating subject. So there is a way of actually scientifically documenting what goes on in the brain during hypnosis.
Yes, you can see it on PET scans. You can see it on EEGs as well, as I believe.
Did you ever read a book called Flow?
Yes, Zick McCauley.
Excellent book.
Yes.
Flow talks about focus and what you can achieve when you experience that pleasantness of just total focus and total concentration on one thing. And in a modern world, I think we get bombarded with so much information and so many different things coming from different directions that I think we lose the pleasure of focusing on one thing at a time. What's your take on that?
Yes, and so the primal work, which I cannot pronounce his name, I think it's Jessica McCallie, but Susan Jackson, and he wrote Flow in Sports. So it was taking his primal work, which was in business, and then applied it very specifically to sports. And a brief explanation of that is high-level performers in sport and high-level performers in business have actually very similar traits.
And why is that?
Well, we see things like leadership, stick-to-itiveness, performance under pressure. And as you can see in sport, it's really the only place where competition is effectively measured. Academics, because sometimes teachers may be a little bit more subjective if you go from one school to another, so that's the same thing as the clock is running, the field is a certain size, and you only have so many people to rely upon. So when we look at what happens in competition in sport, we see the same kinds of effective performance under pressure and decision-making as we do in leadership. So I think if you take a look at the presidents, I think the number one sport the presidents of the United States played, I think, was football. So you'll see that a lot of universities, and particularly the Ivies, if an athlete comes out of an Ivy League school, automatically companies are looking at these kids because they're very bright, and they're also athletes because they've been in positions of competition, and they make great candidates for high levels of performance.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting topic.
Yeah, because most of them don't make it in professional sports. Or they wouldn't have been playing at the Ivy Leagues anyway if they really wanted to go on to professional sports. Let me ask you something, though. What if you're working with a young person who is maybe a very good athlete but has a lot of attention deficit? How do you work with that young person? Or are you telling me that because focus is so important that is going to be very difficult to be, let's say, ADHD and still, be a good athlete?
I think, again, it gets back to regulation of attention. So let's try a very simple technique. I'm sure you've had the experience of reading a paragraph and not remembering anything you've read. If you go back now and you say, I'm going to read that paragraph and I'm going to intend on picking up one piece of information. I'm going to look for the most important sentence. If you read that paragraph, you'll read it very differently. So your intention drives your attention drives your decision-making. So a brief aside about attention deficit disorders, it's overdiagnosed. Many attention disorders are really anxiety-based conditions. Anyone has an anxiety condition will have an attentional disorder. You want to be able to differentially diagnose those kinds of processes. So let's say an athlete has a legitimate attentional deficit disorder, it doesn't mean that they can't use their attention. It means at times they may even become hyper-focused. So when mom says, come to the dinner table, and a child is still playing, moms will say that, he's inattentive. Well, he's hyper-attentive. So
right.
Being hyper-attentive might make a very good athlete, but that's an attention disorder as well. So we have to make sure we're differentially diagnosing what attention disorders are, what's the etiology, and then be able to try to remediate it. Actually, hyperactive kids, attentional deficit kids, make very good subjects for hypnosis, surprisingly.
Really?
Yes.
And why is that?
I would say that a fair number of kids with attention disorders have some form of anxiety. And I dare to say, because I think it's overdiagnosed, that a lot of those kids really have anxiety, and it's not a true attentional disorder in organic basis.
Interesting. The concern that a lot of people have with ADHD kids is that they seem to think they need to medicate this. It happens in schools all the time. Sometimes it's just, you know, you've got young children, they're very active, they can't really focus for a long period of time because their minds and their brains are not physiologically developed to do that. And if you talk to anyone who's ever been a kindergarten teacher or a teacher in the younger grades, they know that young children sometimes have often a very short attention span, so they have to tailor each lesson to that.
But, you know, I'm going to interrupt you one minute, though, because one of the things, and I know you work with a lot of football players, one of the things that I've noticed, I have a little grandson who played little Pop Warner football, and one of the things that I would see, the first practices that these kids, I mean, they'd be all over the place. I mean, we're talking about 8 and 9 year olds, and what I did see, although maybe they are following some of what you do, because these coaches, by about the third or fourth practice, these kids were really focused on what they had to do. And it sounds to me that that's one of the things that you're working with, is to really focus the athletes, get a test. And I'd like to know a little bit more about this, the test that you do to figure out what they need.
Sure. It's called the Test of Attentional and Interpersonal Style. It's called the TAIS, T-A-I-S. It was standardized on Olympic athletes by Dr. Robert Neidhofer. Dr. Neidhofer has been my mentor for a good over 20 years or so. He developed the test, and I was a student of his. It's standardized Olympic athletes used by the Navy SEALs and Fortune 500 companies. We have norms for NFL, MLB, that kind of thing, and also I have norms now for Division I lacrosse, gymnasts, that kind of thing. So there are different attentional styles that are necessary depending upon the sport that you're playing. So as we get that information, that's exactly how we start to develop this whole attentional shifting. You know, so for example, most coaches are going to focus on confidence. And I really move away from that. If we have time, I'll explain the reason for it. I move away from feeling, and we look at what you need to do. It's not how you feel you're going to do. It's how you actually do what you have to do. Now, if you take a look at European countries and Asian countries, you'll see that that's a lot of what their training is about. They don't really pay much attention to confidence because they're actually working on execution. And when an athlete learns to direct their attention to what they need to do to throw the ball, to run quickly, to explode off the line, we're not talking to them about how they feel about this. I'm talking with them about what literally they have to do. And the change in performance, here are several examples. Two girls, juniors in high school, I saw them for one session, and they were both high jumpers. And one had been jumping 2 inches below her best jump from last year, and the other one wanted to jump a little bit higher than where she was. After one session, one girl jumped 4 inches higher than she'd been jumping all year. The other girl, for the first time in her life, jumped 2 inches higher. And all I had them do was focus on one or two very specific things that they had to do to perform. I didn't speak with them about confidence. That's probably unusual. You would think that someone going to a psychologist is going to be talking about confidence. I really stay away from that. It's overrated. It's a very ineffective way of measuring who's going to perform at a high level.
Well, that's interesting, and it brings me up to, maybe I'm old school. I recognize I'm old school, but I can't believe that today it seems like everybody who goes out for a sport has to get a trophy. So what is that building? I mean, I can't believe it. I just don't think you give every kid a trophy just because he shows up. But am I wrong? Is that helpful?
It's actually hurting
Good.
Society. Okay, so participation trophies. And the research on this, if you look at Carol Dweck's mindset, Carol's from Stanford. And what you'll see in there is that as a result of participation trophies and everyone getting in honors classes and all the kinds of things that are happening in some schools, that by the time these kids are getting into college, they're now up against competition that they didn't have before and are having difficulty being able to hear that they didn't perform at their highest level. And they're looking for positive reinforcement. And the opposite of this is what's called grit. Probably heard of grit. So if you look up Angela Duckworth's work at UPenn, you can actually take her 12-question grit tests online, free, at University Penn site and look up Angela Duckworth and grit. She identifies several factors, maybe 5 to 7. I look at 3, passion, perseverance, and a very low need for positive reinforcement. Now,
so say those 3 again.
Passion.
Uh-huh.
Perseverance.
Right.
A low need for positive reinforcement. Now, you're going to see coaches, parents, teachers working a lot on positive reinforcement. I'm not against it. But when there's a high need for positive reinforcement, the only time you're going to progress is if you're actually positively being reinforced. Now, people who have grit don't stop. So if their performance is not high, they don't start feeling badly. They spend time trying to find out what to do. All my athletes get 2 questions after they've finished their performance. Did you get it done? Yes or no? And what did you learn? If you got it done, what did you learn? Well, I learned that I could do it. I could do it under pressure. If you didn't get it done, what did you learn? I don't ask them how they feel about it. I don't talk with them about their confidence, because confidence is not a very good predictor of performance. And actually, Duckworth's work with 7th graders, the best predictor of performance was grit. It wasn't past academic experiences or intellect. So there's a lot of phenomenon that goes on out there. And if you haven't worked with a psychologist or a sports psychologist, it's not all the feel stuff. And it's really scientifically researched.
Well, in fact, that kind of reminds me of back when I was in graduate school, and even with some animals, we found that intermittent reinforcement was better than reinforcement every time. In other words, you didn't give that rat a little cookie every time. But it was intermittent, and that did seem, I think there were some studies back then.
Yes.
Believe me, this was a long time ago.
Well, probably no longer than my training.
The other thing that I do remember, something else you mentioned, is I'll never forget when I went to law school, all of a sudden, all of these kids who'd been bright and been the best were in with others who were bright, and there was a lot of anxiety. I mean, I was just... You know, maybe because I really was different, because I can't tell you how anxious so many of my law school compadres were just so anxious, because for the first time they were up against competition that, you know, everybody was fairly smart.
Everybody was hardworking and everybody was talented.
And...
Well, It's an interesting phenomenon. You know what? And it makes me want to ask a question. You talk about the low need for positive reinforcement.
Right.
How many times have you gone to a sporting event and somebody from the visiting team is now in the middle of performing, maybe before the ball comes to him, or he runs out on the field, or she skates out onto the ice, or out to the court, and everybody boos? I've always found that in my own work, and I'm a lawyer as well, when I walk into a room where people don't like me, or don't like my client, or they're angry at my client, or they're afraid of my client, or they're afraid of me, I find that very energizing, and I find that very helpful in my performance. Can you speak to that issue?
Sure. Performance under pressure with high-performing individuals increases their performance. It doesn't decrease it. So if you just take a look at a simple golf shot, 65 yards out, the center of the fairway to a pin in the center of the green is an easy shot. Now, 65 yards out in the rough, over a sand trap to a pin tucked behind it and the green falling away is a harder one. professionals that play at their highest level would prefer the second shot because it actually increases their focus. So high-level performers are drawn into greater competition. The higher the competition, the greater is the performance. So if your team is very high-performing and you're maybe not be meeting them, a la the Patriots and the Giants a couple of years ago. When the Patriots, I think, had gone 16 or 17-0 and Giants.
That's because it's such a poor league. They're not in the NFL. They're not out there playing.
Well, the Patriots get to play the Jets twice. So,
yeah. Well,
you got to give them.
Yeah.
Now
you're impinging on our area.
So when you find high level of competition, it raises performance up.
Let's follow up on that. You were a pro athletes, hadn't you?
Yes.
And what's that like?
Professional athletes?
Yeah, when you work with a professional level athlete, what kinds of things do you do that are different?
Not much.
Not really?
I think maybe the difference is that you actually work with them, not their handlers. And one of the things that too many of them are so surrounded by everyone who's giving them all these positive reinforcement. What do you do when you actually are, I guess, working directly with the athlete? How do you deal with that they don't have 10 other people in the room with them?
No, I don't. I mean, typically, and I've run into some difficulties with some agents. I've been fired by agents because I spoke too many times with an athlete. Mm-hmm. So there's not really a lot of difference between professional and amateur athletes except their skill sets and the levels of competitions that they've faced. At some point, they were not performing at a high level. They suffer a lot of anxiety. For example, there's more guys on the PGA Tour seeing people like me than seeing swing coaches. So when I work with a tour player, nobody else is around, just the player. The caddy. I'll work with a caddy, but I won't work with anybody else.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up in about a minute, but
sure.
That's very interesting. And I would assume that one of the things about people in the individual sports like golf is they recognize that everybody is looking at them, not just at the team. That has to be, it's like the tennis player or the golfer who's doing, you know, as an individual. You said you were a car racer. Well, granted, people are looking at you, but there should be a lot of cars on that track. So I wonder I would think that would have an impact on someone knowing that, you know, everybody is focused on them.
I think in the beginning stages of your career, but as you direct your attention to where it needs to be, it really doesn't become very much of the issue.
Really?
The other thing, and I'll say this very quickly, a lot of the players that I see on team sports don't want their coaches to know that they're seeing me.
Really?
Yes.
Really? That's interesting.
Well, I would think that some of the teams would be hiring you to
Well, I work with Yale. I work with Yale's lacrosse team, yes, and Lafayette's. Yeah.
But I would think that the professional sports teams...
They have their own guys.
But they do have psychologists.
Most teams do. Not all college teams do, and the high school teams around here, most of them don't.
Right.
So even professionals that have their own team psychologists will sometimes see me individually for their own issues.
Okay.
Well, that's fascinating. Nick, how do people find you?
It's drnickmolinaro.com or drnickgolf.com.
And where's your office?
It's in Mendham, New Jersey.
Okay.
And what's the street address there?
It's 6 East Main, down the street from the Black Horse Inn.
And do you have an office phone number and a website?
And anybody who gets to see him then can go down to the Black Horse and right. Have a great meal. I really am sorry we're going to have to wrap this up. I have one spot we have to play, and we hope you'll come back. And next time
Thank you.
You won't have the car trouble because this has really been very interesting.